Hey everybody, thank you so much for coming. Special thanks also to Thomas and Nana for everything. So I wrote something in January and I read it and I talked about what a special person my mom was, how generous she was, and her appreciation of beauty was also a big theme, and as well as just how she was able and willing to just drop everything whenever I wanted to talk and see her. Not that she had all that much going on to drop, but it was always great just to constantly have that support there for me, and that's who she was. She was always there and always available. We used to talk on the phone. Well, when I went to law school, almost every other day, at least, and especially when I would get on the bus from school, I would always call her. And I really miss that conversation because she was like the person who I would call when I just like didn't have anything really valuable to say to anyone, but I just felt like calling someone, you know. So it's, we all really miss her. My dad, he misses her too. So I had to put that out there because he wishes he could be there, be here today as well. And when me and Thomas were going through her things, it was really interesting. She saved everything. And so it was like we learned things about her that we didn't even know about her. She had this amazing system of organization that no one could really understand except for her, but I think it worked for her sometimes. And she saved stuff that I couldn't believe. I mean, on one hand, she saved her pay stubs from Barnes & Noble, so like a stack of them this big. To me, it's just like, why? But I know that she had a reason for that. But what was really touching was that she saved like my scribble scrabble from when I was in kindergarten in Boston. And so that was really special. She even saved some of my college essays that I didn't even save. So she had her special ways of showing that she cared about people. And one thing that we found when we were going through her stuff was this sort of autobiographical piece. And I realized that a lot of you may have known her when she was younger and may not have really known the person who she was most recently and the person who I know her to be. And so I just wanted to share it with you because it's her words about her life from her. So, all right, I will begin. A Brief Biography of My Life by Jennifer Gilliam. I'll tell you a little bit about myself. I was born and raised in Europe. My father, an American Army officer, had been doing a tour of duty in Germany when he met his bride, my mother, in the mid-1950s. After having lived for most of our young lives in Germany, France, and Italy, my two younger brothers, we are each a year apart, and I were packed up and whisked off to Florence, South Carolina. I was 15 when I began my last 2 years of high school, and I went on to college to get my BA in art history at the University of South Carolina after a brief stint in 1.5 years at Clemson. I have a master's in German literature and one in English literature. For 10 years, I was married to a scientist. A geneticist whose first name is Conrad, and we have a daughter, Clinton, who teaches at the Churchill School on the East Side. Today I live alone with my cat, Paxel, on the Upper West Side. My husband and I lived in London and Boston for 7 years, In London, I gave birth to my daughter, and in Boston, I got very ill, suffering from depression and a dissociative disorder. And within 3 years, my marriage broke up. After the divorce, Conrad moved to Manhattan in 1985 with Quentin, where he got a job as a professor of genetics at Columbia Medical School. And Quentin went to Bing Street School for the next 8 years. For the next 2 years, I lived and worked in Boston, growing lonely and depressed, and I was unable to keep my job. Since they say that home is where the heart is, I felt the need to be close to my little girl, who is very close to my heart. Those 2 years in Boston were painful for me because I lost two people I love most in the world. So I moved to Manhattan. Conrad allowed me to live in his apartment. I was in bad shape, but being close to my daughter brought back happiness I had not felt for 2 years. Unfortunately, in March of 1987, my father suddenly died in a boating accident in North Carolina. Through his death, I suddenly saw my childhood in a different light. I discovered that it was a broken series of depression and anxiety. In a way, his death brought about an extended journey through the landscape of my mental illness. It was not long after my father's death that I was committed to a psychiatric ward in Columbia Presbyterian Hospital in Washington Heights, near the New York State Psychiatric Institute, where I eventually ended up after the 6 month stay at Columbia Presbyterian. After that stay, I was transferred to NYSPI on the long-term wing for people with personality disorders, where I was eventually misdiagnosed with what was called multiple personality disorder. I spent 7 long years of my life in that wing, from when the time I was 31 until I was 38 in 1994. However, what was initially a terrifying place eventually became a home to me, a place where I felt safe for the first time in a while. I made many good friends there, and I've continued to have long-lasting friendships with several people I met during my extensive stay there. It was there that I got in touch with my creative side again. I began to draw and paint hundreds of pictures of feelings, fears, anger, sadness, and even a little happiness. Pictures that represented my mixed up, jumbled, messy life as it had been for me for many years since early childhood. It was through art that I began to make sense of my life. There were pictures on the walls in hallways all along the locked ward. Crappy photographs from the 50s in Panavision-like colors were scattered up and down the hallways on the walls. I became obsessed with transforming them, just as I was slowly transforming myself through my drawings and my never-ending talk therapy. In one photograph, there was a picture of a very placid, characterless lake with dull-colored trees all around it. We had lots of magazines on the unit for some reason, and I thumbed through them. Over time, I began to see figures of people and things that I thought would fit perfectly in the photograph of the lake on the wall. By the time I had finished cutting out and pasting the magazine pictures, the photograph on the wall had been transformed beyond recognition. The picture on the wall had become a perverse scene of a naked man fishing, ladies floating on air mattresses in bathing suits and drinking martinis on the surface of the lake. There were dwarves hiding behind many of the trees that surrounded the lake, and vacationers water skiing through around a toxic waste dump sign that I stuck and glued in the middle of the lake. There were dwarves hiding behind many of the trees that surrounded the lake, parrots and superheroes flying through the air, a shark jumping out of the water in one corner of the lake, and countless other strange things that struck my vivid imagination. By the end of the 7 years, I had renovated every single photograph with the strangest, conflicting, and most humorous images I could find. The nurses would bring in more and more magazines for me to peruse and discover fitting images to cut out and glue onto all the photographs on the walls inside the unit. From gluing pictures cut out of magazines, I began to work on huge, complex collages that paralleled what I was going through in my therapy. Collage is an excellent, perhaps even the best method of helping people to discover feelings which they are not aware of. It is an excellent medium for self-awareness and the discovery of deeply hidden feelings. For the first time in my life, I began to feel that I was safe. This was the result of my artwork, my friendships with fellow patients and staff on the unit where I lived, as well as all the hard work I was doing in my therapy. But life on this long-term unit was not all bright and sunlight and laughter. I spent 3 years on suicide watch, which they called CO for constant observation. Someone from staff followed you around everywhere you went. Their eyes were always on you. It became unbearable after a while. Just as I had a hard time adjusting to the long-term personalities unit, I had an even harder time fitting into the outside world after I left the hospital. When I finally left the unit, I moved into a psychiatric residence. There I became acquainted with an entirely different sort of mentally ill person. The people I had been living with previously were all intelligent, creative, articulate, and to a large extent humorous people. There were troubled borderlines and the conscientious, but highly charming sociopaths, the entertaining and fascinating histrionics, the egocentric narcissists, and then the large body of patients who, like me, didn't seem to fit into any one category. To be honest, I was at first taken aback by what I observed from my new neighbors. A few of them frequently rocked themselves into quiet trance-like states. Several seemed to communicate past each other in non sequiturs. Some recited scripture, both biblical and their own personal versions, and many others wore warm coats and hot weather. They were all not as eccentric as I've described, indeed. Most are kind, intelligent, articulate people, but there was enough unusual behavior for me to take notice. I've lived with them here in the residence for many years now and grown accustomed to their idiosyncrasies and distinctive behaviors. Indeed, I've discovered I'm not so different from any of them. We all feel pain, we feel the same frustrations, we feel equally insulted and stigmatized by ignorant people who think of themselves as normal and therefore superior to us while they look at us as if we were bizarre three-eyed monkeys. For the past 5 years, I have been selling my work in different galleries, but only recently have I decided to devote all my time to my artwork. Lately, I was featured along with a few other artists in the Village Voice. Jennifer Goneman wrote an article on my art and the art of other mentally ill artists I live with. Today I have my own apartment, part of which I've converted to my studio. It hasn't been an easy life. 6.5 years ago, I had a roommate named Anne who set the shower curtain on fire one night. I heard her screaming from the bathroom that it was on fire, so I ran to see if she needed my help. And just as I stepped into the room past her, she pushed me in to the shower curtain and closed the bathroom door. I quickly went up in flames. The residents had not put smoke detectors in our apartments, and neither was there a functioning fire alarm in the building. By the time I escaped the fire, it had gone out on its own, but I was left with third-degree burns over 40% of my body. I spent 4 months in the burn unit at the New York Presbyterian Hospital. I was in a drug-induced coma and on a respirator. Most of my burns are on my neck, upper torso, back, and arms. My face was not burned, and for that I am grateful. My entire life, I never felt as much pain as I felt during this hospitalization. I cannot describe pain with words. I can, however, approach a likeness to it in my art. If you look at the portrait, which, by the way, I have it in the binder in the back if anybody would like to take a look at it afterwards, which began as a self-portrait but developed into something else altogether, you will see the pain and sorrow that I experienced because of what happened to me. In the drawing, I chose not to put scars on my neck because most of the time I don't feel as if I'm scarred, although I am in constant pain. It is only when I look into the mirror or into the faces of people who pass me on the street that I feel I have scarred. My art reflects my experience because I choose to allow it to. Therefore, I feel that I have to do some, I feel that I do have some control over my life. When something as dramatic as what I experience happens to a person, they feel powerless and a victim. My art empowers me because through it I can express my feelings, my thoughts, and ideas, my love, my anger, and hatred. As long as I can communicate through my art, I feel that I have control over my life. In that way, I need art in the same way that one needs air to breathe and stay alive. Thank you guys all, and I know we all really miss Jennifer.